you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to be with you today. Some parts of Southern California seeing the rain taper. Other parts, there's still plenty of rain coming down. And we hope you stay safe as you make your way around the region. Coming up a little bit later, LAPD Chief Michael Moore, his final appearance as chief as he retires in just about a week. We have a lot to talk with him about. What he saw unfold over his decades-long career with LAPD and work he thinks is important for his successor to prioritize. But we begin, speaking of the range, with the tremendous challenge that the Palos Verdes Peninsula has been facing with landslides, with homes that have been red-tagged, and of course with the closure of the beautiful architectural showpiece that is the Wayfarers Chapel. We got that word last week. And heartbreaking for so many people, including people who had weddings scheduled just days later, who had to scramble to find another location for their big event. We're going to be talking about how the different communities on the peninsula are responding to the challenge that's been brought by this unprecedented movement of land. Joining us first is a resident of the peninsula, LAist reporter who's been covering the land movement, Yusra Farzan. Yusra, thanks so much for being with us. Now, I understand you make your daily commute through this area of land movement. What's that been like?
Thanks, Larry. Yeah, I take PV Drive South, in the mornings to drop my daughter off at school. And every day is a different drive. Sometimes it's very smooth. Sometimes it's very bumpy. I'm always seeing, road crews over there working because it goes through their landslide complex. And it is a very important road because it connects the residents in the peninsula to Long Beach, to other cities in the South Bay. And it's also an evacuation road. So it is a very important street in PV. Just a few months ago, Burma Road had to close down because of the land movement. And that was also an evacuation road. And because that road closed down, it resulted in the closure of trails in the area. And I'm sure, for listeners would know, PV is known for its hiking trails.
Oh, incredible trails. I've hiked some of them. And it's just, it's a beautiful place to live or to hike or to visit. Absolutely. So land movement, historically, there's been a lot of it, including historic landslides, I know, on the peninsula. But since it's been developed with homes, have we ever had anything that's comparable in the way of land movement?
I've been speaking to the city geologist, in my reporting, and what he's been describing is unprecedented land movement in the last 15 months. So it's gone from, inches of movement to feet in the last 15 months, he said it was a ninefold increase. We've seen land move 7 feet in some areas.
Wow.
And I've noticed it, when I go down there, I've seen intersections close down. I spoke with a resident yesterday who lives opposite a house that was red tagged last year. She's lived in the area for 19 years and she's never had issues except for last year, where she started noticing cracks in her house. There were cracks in her garage last summer, so she can't use it anymore. There's a manhole that's open in front of our home. A power line snapped in front of our home. So it's very dangerous conditions just within the last 15 months because of the historic rainfall that we've seen.
We're talking about the Palos Verdes Peninsula, which at one point in global history was actually an island when sea levels were higher. Now, of course, a peninsula, beautiful place to live and to recreate here in Southern California. But we're talking about the big challenges faced with the land movement there. In addition to our Yusra Farzan, we're joined by John Cruikshank, who's the mayor of Rancho Palos Verdes, the city attempting to have a declaration of disaster, which would be helpful with remediating what needs to be done. Mayor Cruikshank, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me this morning.
So just share with us within your city, which is one of a few there on the peninsula, how are you dealing with this?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for covering this and I guess your great and kind words about our city and the Palos Verdes Peninsula. So our city of Rancho Palos Verdes, as was mentioned, the last couple of rain cycles have been unprecedented. And of course, that's created the additional movement that you were just mentioning there in our city. And so how we're dealing with it is we're a multifaceted approach with different government agencies. And last night at our city council meeting, our council voted unanimously to send a request for a state of emergency for our specific area, the Greater Portuguese Bend Landslide Complex. And we believe with the governor's assistance in declaring that state of emergency for us, that'll allow us to be able to move forward with projects that we believe will help mitigate the landslide, reduce the movement, and get some normalcy back to our residents in that area.
So what would that mean that you could get projects underway without the typical environmental review or the Coastal Commission? Or how as a practical matter would that help you?
Well, that's correct. So prior to even the last couple of years, in fact, the last several years, we've been working on a project to mitigate the movement because, as your listeners probably are aware, it didn't just start a couple of years ago. This is an ancient landslide complex that was activated back in the 1950s when there was road construction going on in our area. So this area has been moving since that time. And every year, our city and the county with their sewer lines, and we've been maintaining that. And as Yusra mentioned in her drive, every so often it does move. And we actually call that stretch, that 1 mile stretch, the roller coaster. And there's one area that's even called the ski slope because it's such a dramatic drop in the road. So it's nothing new in regards to land movement, but what we believe how this will help with the governor's office is to help us move that project where we are in the midst of preparing an environmental impact report and addressing comments to that report. As many people probably are aware, it does take several years sometimes to address comments and to move through that process. And so we're asking the governor to allow us to move forward with some of the work. Of course, we're not going to be forgetting about the environmental requirements. We want to work through those comments and through the concerns while we're taking actions now to help our residents because of the unprecedented movement that's going on.
We're talking with the mayor of Rancho Palos Verdes, John Cruikshank. I'd love to hear from residents of PV to share with us what you've been going through, either with your commute, if your home has had to respond, to deal with significant damage, you've had challenges with that, please share them with us, or on your street with your neighbors. Please share with us what you're experiencing on the peninsula as the result of this unprecedented, at least since development of the peninsula, movement of land. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Again, the phone number, I'd love to hear from PV residents talking about what you're dealing with these torrential rains and land movement, 866-893-5722. Mayor Cruikshank, all the modeling that we see as the climate warms is that we're going to get more of these very intense rain events, spread out with droughts and extreme precipitation. What, if anything, can the city do to try and respond to that, given the geologic vulnerability of the peninsula?
Well, that's a big question. And I'm actually a licensed civil engineer as well. And so engineers always try to search for solutions. And as you mentioned, as we have different weather patterns that are much greater than we're used to seeing, like we have over the last couple of years with this unprecedented amount of rainfall, we need to take actions that can protect certain vulnerable areas like this landslide area. We believe that there's two causes. Number one, water entering that area that actually soaks right into the ground instead of making its way to the ocean. Most of the water that does fall on the Palos Verdes Peninsula does soak into the ground. In this particular location, we would like to, first of all, fill all these large fissures that are basically recharging the water table, unfortunately, and further lubricating the slip plane. Also, we want to construct drainage swales, line certain canyons with a non-penetrable membrane, so to make sure that water doesn't soak in and makes its way down the hill, and installing drain pipes. And then finally, we'd like to install a number of dewatering wells that are basically horizontal hydro augers that will relieve the pressure and the water and reduce the water table in that area.
All right. We're talking with the mayor of Rancho Palos Verdes, John Cruickshank. My apologies for that sound that burst in the middle of the answer that he was giving to us. Is there any way to hasten the landslide, like control it, for example, so that part of the movement can be done in anticipation, done with earth moving equipment, or is it just so massive that's not realistic?
So many attempts have been made for the past several decades to hasten the movement. At one point, they had put a number of large concrete reinforced caissons at the beach level, just because of the massive amount of earth that's coming down toward the ocean. Those basically just sheared off. So what we found is that it's putting any type of physical barrier in front of the movement has proven to be too challenging and too costly. We've heard many people talk about building a bridge over it, but of course you'd have to anchor it to something, which you couldn't do. And of course that's a mile wide landslide. So that would just be too cost prohibitive. So many attempts have been made, but we feel based on all the studies over the last several decades that we're on to solutions that will make real differences out there.
So you think long-term the road can be saved?
Well, I believe that the amount of movement can be reduced greatly so that that road can continually be maintained and kept open. As was mentioned, that road is a regional connector between not just our Palos Verdes Peninsula cities, but also San Pedro, Torrance, Redondo Beach. So it's a very important roadway. It's also an important potential access point because, as we even talked about last night, it's raining now, but once it starts to dry out, now we end up with dry brush and weeds and end up with fire hazards again. So if there were, God forbid, a fire to occur and we needed to evacuate residents off the peninsula, that Palos Verdes Drive is a major thoroughfare and an access point to many of our residents. And so that road is critical to our operations and our safety.
We're talking with the mayor of Rancho Palos Verdes, John Cruickshank. John, just as an aside, is it just coincidental you happen to be a civil engineer and the mayor of Rancho Palos Verdes, or is that related at all?
No, well, that's a great question. It's almost coincidental. I've lived here in this community for 20 plus years, and I have been a civil engineer for my entire professional life. And I actually did run for office touting the fact that I am an engineer.
Okay.
I do tell many of my friends, hey, we need more engineers in public service because of just our background.
All right. Let's talk with Alyssa, who's in Rancho Palos Verdes. Good to have you with us. Alyssa, how have you been experiencing the damage caused by the landslide?
Hi, I'm listening to you, and I just had to call in because it is extremely scary. I drive that road every day to take my daughter to high school, and you have to drive with extreme caution, and every day it's different. There seems to be new damage, and many of the kids will take public transit as we have two high schools on the peninsula, and I'm afraid to even have my daughter drive on the bus because the roads are so scary right now.
Alyssa, thank you for sharing that. And so, Mayor Cruikshank, to what extent are you monitoring the road? Because I know the movement can happen, you know, weeks after this rain event, months after this rain event. So how frequently do you inspect it to make sure that it is safe, addressing the concerns Alyssa's expressing?
Well, I appreciate Alyssa's concerns, and I think the only silver lining to this landslide is that it is a slow-moving landslide complex. So the rains that we just had, you don't necessarily see further movement until a week or two after the event. So we did talk about moving several feet per year, but if you kind of divide that by the number of days, it's not moving several feet per day, fortunately. Our city is monitoring the roads pretty much every day as much as possible. And when they do find it to be impassable or to be a danger or threat to our motoring public, they will get out there and repair the road. So quite frequently, our residents and our guests will see the road crews out there working on those roads. So constantly, every week at this point, we're doing something new out there.
Mayor, just before I let you go, you know, so many people are concerned about the future of Wayfarers Chapel, and we understand a number of the windows were cracked as a result of land movement, that there is structural concern about the integrity of the building. Are you in talks with the operators of the chapel about whether it can be saved?
No, we are in talks with them. In fact, they attended our city council meeting last night, and we attended their press conference last week when they announced their closure. Of course, any of you that have been to the Wayfarers Chapel know it's a gem.
One of a kind.
One of a kind for this nation, and a beautiful structure, but it's a very delicate structure. It's a redwood structural members with glass, all glass. And so you can imagine how landslide movement would affect that, and it's we are going to work closely with Wayfarers Chapel to get them back up and operational as quick as possible. But we first need to get the land movement to be slowed down to the rate that we're more accustomed to prior to that happening.
All right, Mayor Cruikshank, thank you so much. We appreciate you filling us in on the latest in Rancho Palos Verdes. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
John Cruikshank, the mayor of Rancho Palos Verdes, and our own Yusra Farzan, LAist reporter, who's been covering this story. And it hits close to home, literally, for her, as she's describing the roller coaster road that she takes with PV Drive South to come here to our LAist studios. Yusra, thanks so much. And we'll look forward to your continuing coverage of this at LAist.com.
Thanks, Larry.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, Michael Moore, his final visit to us on Air Talk as the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. He has just about a week left before his retirement. We'll talk with him about the major events during his decades-long career on the force and what he sees as the biggest challenges awaiting a successor. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by LAPD Chief Michael Moore. He's chief for just about another week. Then Dominic Choi, high-ranking official in the department, becomes the interim chief until a successor is chosen for a five-year term for the head of the department. Chief Moore, good to have you back with us. First, I appreciate all the visits that you've had over these what's it been, 6 years?
Yes.
Now? So appreciate it so much. So how are you feeling with a week to go in your term?
Well, I'm excited. It's a change of a turning of a page, a new chapter, and at the same time, it's bittersweet. It's been a part of my life for more than four decades, and certainly an honor and a privilege to have served as chief of this great city, of a great department, I think the finest police department in all of America. And with that, though, I'm also excited to, you know, as we turn that chapter, that page into the next chapter, to look forward to spending more time with my family. We'll be leaving the state and getting near my daughter. So Sunday night dinners will be back to our routine. And that's just something I think many of us who spend our lives in these type of long-term professions, you know, look forward to, is eventually moving into a more relaxed setting, if you would.
Well, I'm sure you're not going to miss the stress, the demand of a job that's pretty much 24/7 and has been for 6 years and through a number of crises as well. But are you going to go through withdrawals? You say it's been more than 40 years. This has been your life.
Well, certainly. This is a lifestyle. In fact, I speak with frequently with new command officers and people who join this profession as well, from so at all levels. It does become a lifestyle. It is part of being a police officer, I think. And I think, frankly, it's something the public expects, that we're police officers, that the status, the respect, but also the responsibilities are one that exists both on and off duty. And so after this many decades and having seen so much and experienced it, but also enjoyed so much of it, it will be a change. But again, I've seen this date coming, and it's something that I have planned and anticipated. And I know there'll be adjustments, but I believe that these are all opportunities. Every day is a blessing, and today is today is, as I sit and reflect over the past, I'm encouraged. I'm there's things I wish I'd done differently. There's much to be proud of, and as I leave the organization, I know I leave it in good hands with the appointment of interim chief Dominic Choi, a great man, a great leader, a tremendous team builder, a person who's going to continue with a steady hand with this organization as we build our engagements with our public, as we build trust, continue to pursue crime reduction, community engagement, a host of other strategies that are well in hand.
With incoming interim chief Choi, do you anticipate that he is going to make any significant changes, or will his role, as you expect, be largely only make very incremental changes awaiting the permanent successor?
Well, Dominic has been a senior member of my team now for more than a few years. He was previously a chief of staff. He's currently over the operations of the majority of the organization. And I suspect that he'll continue in the delivery of our strategic plan, one that has been approved by the Board of Police Commissioners. It lays out the various initiatives and measures and mileposts that we're to pursue and challenge. And I expect that he's going to continue to execute that. He was part of assembling that. Now, having said that, every leader is unique and different. And I'm sure and confident that he will see things differently, as my management team has over the course of my tenure as chief. It's been a discussion on many different fronts. And at this point now, I'll hand the gavel, if you will, to him. And I will say that while I expect consistency and I see success, I also think that the public can expect that this will not be an idle chief. This will not be a placeholder that the department suddenly goes into neutral. There's too much at stake for the safety of Los Angeles. There's too much at stake for the day-to-day, but also the strategic movement of this department. So I think you'll see a chief that's with Dominic that they can be proud of, that they can see that the organization is still going to challenge itself. We're still going to work and strive to build and bolster the trust of the public and improve the safety of Los Angeles.
There are challenges, which we'll get into, that the department continues to face, and ones that have been difficult, I know, for you to overcome in the 6 years. And as you look at some of those, do you think it's possible to make that change with someone from within the department? Or is this a time in the department's history, as there have been a few others, where it could be advantageous for someone from elsewhere to come in and shake things up?
Well, with the interim chief now been determined and decided by the Board of Police Commissioners, and certainly it enjoyed the support of Mayor Bass in the right person at the right time. Now the matter before the Board of Police Commissioners is to work with the mayor, as the mayor is doing outreach across the communities of Los Angeles, as well as her work inside the organization, to understand what are the attributes, not who the person is, but what should that chief represent, and what are the qualities and experience and background and the leadership abilities going forward. I have every confidence that the Board of Police Commissioners are well aware of the attributes of an internal candidate and the benefits that they bring to an organization, as well as potential benefits of an outsider. It is my belief that this organization has tremendous leadership within its ranks at all levels, and that it is my expectation that a number of those individuals within the organization are going to apply for and compete for the permanent chief, as you indicated.
You saw, though, when Bill Bratton came in, that there were some pretty dramatic changes made after his arrival.
There was, and the department was in an entirely different position. The department was in, a state of crisis, which I don't believe, despite others that may say otherwise. I don't believe we're in a state of crisis. We're not a department that is in a consent decree. We're not an organization that is resisting change or obstinate to the or blind to the shortfalls that we have, and I don't believe that this is an organization that requires somebody to come in and turn it from inside out. I think there's a lot going right with this organization. It also is reflective of challenges that are experiencing not just here in Los Angeles, but across major agencies across America in policing, as far as recruitment and retention of personnel, the morale of our organizations, the challenges with criminal justice reforms. There's a host of opportunities that the department is working toward improving its performance and leading American policing and demonstrating ways in which to accomplish constitutional policing, such as our work with pretext stops, such as our work with reforming our use of force, a host of other activities that we're leading American policing in. So Bill Bratton is an individual that, while accomplished and a man I have a great deal of respect for, came in at a time when it was a much different department. So going forward, though, that's not to say that, as the mayor has committed to, this is the second largest city in America. It deserves a nationwide search of anyone who believes they are capable and would perform in an outstanding fashion. And then now the deliberative process will go be on the responsibilities of the Board of Police Commissioners. Later, three names will be provided to their three names that they feel best qualified will be provided to the mayor. And it'll be her on her watch that determination of the chief who will lead, whoever that person is, they will enjoy my support, because their support, their success is the success of the Los Angeles Police Department, and the success of the Los Angeles Police Department is the success of Los Angeles.
We're talking with outgoing LAPD Chief Michael Moore. He has just about a week left in his term. The interim chief of the department will be Dominic Choi. If you have questions for the chief, you can email them to us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. You can call us at 866-893-5722. One of the crises that your department faced in your tenure were the protests on the street and the aftermath of property destruction that came after peaceful protests that were in the street. Your officers at the scene, many of them were criticized for their response and going overboard. You've talked on this program about changes that have been implemented since. Do you have confidence that with protests that occur in the future, that officers will be able to respond in a better way than they did to the post-George Floyd protests?
Well, let me respond first of all to some of those characterizations. I don't believe that many of the officers of the thousands that were deployed in an effort to facilitate peaceful, largely peaceful demonstrations, and then address those that became violent, where officers were viciously attacked, where we saw, and I personally witnessed, officers with broken bones, a fractured skull, lacerations from the violence that members within these demonstrations and protests attacked officers. And in their efforts to defend themselves, as well as to quell violent acts of arson, looting, and so forth, there were instances, not widespread instances, but there were instances in which officers fall short, that their actions were not justified. And we found them when the evidence demonstrated that. We found them out of policy, and we took corrective, including disciplinary action. But they, by no means did they represent the vast majority of men and women that went out there and did their very best. And I stand by the actions of the vast majority that did it right. And at the same time, I thought it was important that we do recognize and acknowledge that there were shortfalls within individuals, as well as shortfalls within the leadership, including myself, areas that I could and should have done better. And in that aftermath of that self-reflection, it should by no means mean that I am embarrassed or that I regret what the department did. What it should represent is it's an organization that is committed to doing better. There is never a great organization that doesn't challenge itself that what can I do better? And going forward, the last 4 years, we spent a considerable amount of time and resources to invest in our people with technology, with tools, with training, to ensure that they have the skill sets as up and down through the entire organization to challenge what I believe will be a challenging year. I think this year in 2024, as we approach the presidential election, the discord that we see, protests and demonstrations, we should and can expect that we will see those demonstrations manifest themselves in the street, as we've seen in the last 6 months. But I do believe, and I'll close, that the training and development and readiness of our people today far outpaces where we were 4 years ago. And I expect to see streets that, while there have demonstrations and protests, that they'll be done in a manner that's peaceful. And should people choose not to be peaceful, and should they choose to engage in unlawful, violent acts, that we'll be able to surgically address them quickly and save lives and protect the property of Los Angeles.
LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us. You mentioned even yourself, you have a critique of how you responded and provided managerial oversight. Is there, what's one specific area where if you had it to do over again, you would have done something different regarding the protest response?
I would have mobilized the organization a day earlier. I believe that we mobilized the organization at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, asked for the National Guard to respond. In retrospect, 12 hours earlier, 16 hours earlier on the second night where we saw not just isolated acts of violence, but a more widespread violence downtown. I should have recognized that was a point where the organization had faced 2 days of or a day and a half of fairly persistent demonstration protests that had escalated to some individual acts of arson and violence. And in retrospect, I wish I'd just pulled the trigger for full mobilization that Friday night.
We'll continue with LAPD Chief Michael Moore about a week in front of his retirement from the department. Dominic Choi will be the interim chief going forward until a 5-year term successor is chosen under the leadership of Mayor Karen Bass. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. We'll be back in a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with outgoing LAPD Chief Michael Moore. More than 4 decades on the force with LAPD and the past 6 years as the chief of the department. Chief, I just want to go back to the protests after the murder of George Floyd, because one of the things that you did, which I think for many of your officers did not sit well, was take a knee with the protesters. In hindsight, do you wish you hadn't done that?
Oh, absolutely not. I absolutely, and I don't think that when you say that, you know, a vast majority or when you say a vast number, I don't know exactly how many officers. There were people within organization that at the moment and then later and some still who believe that that action by me was somehow inappropriate. And I have worked for the last 4 years to articulate my position. It remains the same position as I did that day when out in front of headquarters was a line of bike rail and hundreds of individuals demonstrating and protesting following acts of violence, following acts of arson in the city. I believe it was a Monday morning that it occurred. And we had individuals on the other side of that railing. Demonstrators said, will you kneel with us? Will you talk with us? Will you? And I said, you know, as they're kneeling in front of me, it's like, yes, I'll go eye to eye with you. I put my hand through the railing to shake their hand. There were pictures and photographs. People thought it was a photo moment. It was a spontaneous moment. It was one to demonstrate that this is not we're not an occupying army. We're not the superior position suppressing or oppressing people who have grievances with the government, including with policing, that we're humans, that we're people just like they are, that we have families, that we have wants and needs, that we're the things we agree with in our society, the things we disagree with. But in this moment, what we were looking for was common ground of recognizing that we see them. I saw them. I see their, I hear their pain, their frustration, whether it's on an individual basis or more widespread across policing or across all of our society. Now, there's those who believe that I was kneeling in a sense of submitting myself. I believe that it was a matter of demonstrating the human side of law enforcement, that cops care deeply, that they're willing to sacrifice their lives for others that they don't know because they care for them, and that and not to have the pride or the arrogance that I'm not going to see you on an eye-to-eye as an individual of equal.
There, of course, have been expressed morale problems within the department, and there have been, certainly from the LA Police Protective League, the union, criticism at times of your leadership. How much of the discontent within the department do you think relates to the general state of policing and discouragement that many officers are feeling? How much of it do you think you bear a degree of responsibility for that morale?
Well, I think, first of all, in regards to the overall relationship with LAPPL, the Los Angeles Police Protective League, and the directors, I think overall I've done very well. I continually meet every 2 weeks or more frequently as needed with the league director, Craig Lally, as the president of the league, and we have open dialogue and discussions. There's things that many times that we agree and which I find that actions within the organization did fall short and the members were treated unfairly or overly harsh. There's other times in which we have to agree to disagree. So that open door policy continues to this day. And I'm proud of the work that in the last 5+ years that we've engaged in a dialogue to, I think, to help address morale within the organization and address their grievances. I do believe that I share a weight, as every leader does, regarding the morale of an organization, is to pursue job conditions, treatment, resources, so that people feel that they are recognized, that they have a voice, and that their work matters, and that they're appreciated. And yet, I also reflect across American policing that we are, you know, we're part of that larger societal profession, which has been under tremendous strain, stress, pressure, criticism, often unfair. It's an organization that has gone through a workforce reduction of more than 1,000 officers, more than 300 civilians. Its workload today has never been greater. So it's under a great deal of stress from a number of different avenues. And as chief, it's been my responsibility, and it remains my responsibility until next Thursday, and then it'll become Chief Choi and then his predecessor, to identify ways in which we can recognize, identify those challenges, address them, but also be clear-eyed and understanding that this is a difficult moment in time. I do believe it's getting better. I do believe that, for instance, steps that have been taken by Mayor Bass in establishing a record multi-year contract to identify and recognize the value of officers is not just attracting with recruit flows now coming in, higher interest levels, about 30% higher in applicants today than we were just 6 months ago. But we're also seeing fewer officers leave the organization than we did the year before and the year before that. And we have a number of officers that are asking to come back that left because of the thought of greener pastures.
Oh, but, coming back from other departments where they left?
Yes. And so we are in a good point. And I believe that going forward that we need to be purveyors of hope. We need to be individuals that identify a path forward that to support our men and women. And I ask the public to recognize that they can contribute to that by finding an opportunity that when we're doing something right, to acknowledge that. Because we certainly know that we will make mistakes and fall short, and we will face and should face a criticism of those moments.
We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, just about a week left in his tenure as chief. Mayor Bass has set a 9,500 officer goal to boost up the force of sworn officers. I think the latest I saw is we're looking at 8,900 officers. What is it going to take, and is it realistic to reach 9,500?
Well, 9,500 is just a waypoint. To remind the public, prior to the global epidemic, we were at 10,100 sworn members, about 3,300 sworn civilian professionals. Those numbers are today 8,915 officers and about 2,620 civilians. But it's not just the headcount, if you will. These are people doing meaningful work on a variety of public safety fronts. And this workforce reduction is limiting our ability to do our to be effective as much as effective as we should be able to be in public engagement and being present in our communities and providing for public safety and in preparation for world events such as LA 28, the Summer Games and Paralympics, the World Cup, the Super Bowl is coming back to Los Angeles. There's a number of world events, but just day to day, the workforce that we have today is at historic lows, more than two decades, a smaller workforce. Can we build out of that? Yes, I believe that the strategies that have been identified, which is to tell our story, to attract and retain people who want to be a part of a purpose of an organization to provide for public safety, to ensure that the wages, job conditions, and benefits attract and retain from a very short work pool. I mean, every police agency in America is looking for qualified applicants. So we've got to improve on that. I believe we're on a path there. We've got the right mayor. We've got the majority of the council who believes in that and is supporting us. And I think that the public also, when we look at customer sentiment, when we look at community sentiment, our LMU study that was most recently produced showed that nearly 7 out of 10 Angelenos, the only people they trust more are their neighbors than their local LA police officer. That's an improvement from years before. I think that we're on that recovery because we're demonstrating our purpose, we're demonstrating our engagement, and that we're not going to simply become a reactionary force, but we're here to build the trust of our communities.
LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us, just about a week remaining in his tenure, 6 years as chief of the department, more than 40 years on the LAPD. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Back in a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us here on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. LAPD Chief Michael Moore joining us on Air Talk. Connie Rice, who has worked with the department over so many years on reform measures and in the wake of the Rodney King beating and the L.A. riots, has been a very important figure with LAPD. She wrote a recent op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times, I know that you've seen, in which she identified a number of areas she thought the department needed to improve. One of the issues she identified were Black officers. Many of whom she's spoken with said that they felt that there had been a rise in anti-Black racism, and not just from white colleagues, but from Latino officers in the department, and that this needed to be more proactively addressed to make Black officers feel that they're supported and they're treated as equaled and included. What did you think when you saw that?
Well, I identified it as an issue that we have within the organization, as we have across all of our city departments. There was a recent survey conducted by UCLA at the workplace across major departments in LA, and it found a similar discord. And it's reflective of the region, and it's reflective of our society today. Race relationships today in the United States are at a low point, in my view. And as representatives within law enforcement that have in race relationships, have various images about what law enforcement has, discrimination, hostilities, the treatment of people of color, the unfair treatment of people of color, the harshness of that, is that then we have members within those within those identities that are now part of our department. And from within, they see evidence from time to time of that type of discrimination, that type of hostilities. And with that, they've called out and identified those instances, and they feel that in times there's been instances in which the department or the profession has either undermined or ignored or pushed back against such assertions. I think it's important that when this came up during the aftermath of the George Floyd murder and the civil unrest, is we brought people together of various identities to have this conversation. And feedback I got is it didn't work well. And part of it is because it was too raw. The issues, the emotions were very much still emotionally charged. And any discussion really was more polarizing,
made things worse
than bringing them together. And over the last years, we've worked to try to approach this from different angles, with building relationships with our employee affiliated organization to understand when are there instances where they see that discrimination, that open hostility, when people put a particular television program on as some subtle message about a political posture, or more blatantly, they post political ads or posters within the workplace. And individually, we've addressed those very, very immediately and with punishment and discipline that says that this is not a position where people have the authority, or that they should think that it's a safe space for them to have such divisive, cruel, at times racist, and unprofessional conduct.
And that's not you don't tolerate, you shouldn't be tolerating that in people's personal social media, right? Because they're public servants. They don't have a right to engage in racist language on their own private social media, do they?
When their private social media is not private, meaning that they have identified themselves and the public can see that they're a member of this department. Again, I have been very direct in regards to cautioning our people, reminding them of their responsibilities on and off duty, reminding them that such conduct is unprofessional and will result in disciplinary action, including their removal. And I've sought that. Now, having said that, this is not just a hammer solution, though. We've got to recognize the underlying essence of why individuals with these varying identities have these, these emotions and these beliefs, and what are the things that, other than the organization just taking immediate action, which is important when people break the rules of conduct and the code of conduct, but what are the other ways of also sensitizing officers to understand the perspective of the other person? That always goes back to that kneeling again, right? You've got this individual where you've got, why, my God, how can this chief of police, for everything he represents, demonstrate any type of humanity with this individual who represents this vicious demon? Well, first of all, the person on the other side is not a demon. They have real grievances, and they certainly have and the way we're going to work through that is by first recognizing what we have in common, which is decency and values. And we all want to live a life that is productive, that's rewarding. And we want to be treated fairly and with the rights, regardless of our race, creed, or color. As an organization, we have work to do, and I look forward to, as I hand this baton off, for us to deepen that work and deepen those conversations to improve the sense of fairness across the entire organization.
LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us. We've talked about the challenges that the department's had during your tenure and going forward, but I want to hear from you what you're proudest of, and not just your 6 years necessarily as chief, because you've had many, many years with the department overall, and what, as you leave this position, do you feel best about during those years?
Well, I'll leave that to others primarily. I will say that what I have seen over the last nearly 6 years, and certainly this is my 43rd year with LAPD, is what I commonly refer to as the arc of policing, that it's on a continued path of building trust in our communities. It's not there yet. It is an effort to understand what are the things that pull away from the public's trust of policing, what are things when even our best intentions, the outcomes are unfortunate and erode the confidence in us, what are the things that build and bolster that, that when we look at this, that's a matter of our values. It's a matter of the policies that we make, how we use force, how we don't use force, the levels of the reverence for human life, the proportionality, but also what are the effective enforcement techniques, and when is it more effective to use the shared responsibility of other resources to come and solve problems? In these last nearly 6 years, certainly with the downturn in the staffing of this organization, I'm most proud of that unmatched in this country, is our ability to maintain service levels of responding to and protecting Angelenos from particularly acts of violence, gun violence and otherwise, but also to protect local communities. And it isn't perfect, but when you look at the workforce, the reduction that we've experienced, the fact of the matter is many other agencies today have curtailed services to the point where even on violent crimes, they're taking them by a phone call. And we have been able to avoid that because we've prioritized our staffing at the area level. We've prioritized the importance of officers on patrol. And we've also prioritized that our outreach engagement. We've not become what I'll commonly refer to as a fire department where we just simply respond to call to call to call. Our measurement hasn't been, well, what's your routine call for service time? It's been instead, how do we build trust in neighborhood by neighborhood? And what are the activities that bolster that? And what are the activities that take away from that? Lastly, in such times of scarcity of resources, we could have pulled away from our community safety partnership engagement, where we build these unique across 10 sites, we're adding two more this year, of officers trained and assigned to areas to build public confidence, to build community resilience. We could have pulled away from that. We could have pulled away from what the lessons have been learned from that and how to incorporate that in other parts of the organization.
Chief Moore, thank you so much. I want to thank you again for your willingness to come on and join us monthly like this. It's great you have a chance to connect with LAist listeners and to talk with them about what's going on with the department. We wish you very well in retirement and with your family. Thanks so much.
God bless you. I appreciate you.
Thank you. That's Michael Moore, outgoing LAPD chief, and we look forward to talking with Interim Chief Dominic Choi once he takes office in just another week or so. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. I just got an update on the ticket count for our upcoming 22nd annual Film Week Academy Awards preview at the historic Orpheum Theater in downtown LA. We've sold several hundred tickets already, and we typically get the rush of ticket sales in the final 2 weeks before the event. So I want to make sure you don't miss out. Get a good seat right now. All 11 of our film critics are going to be on stage at the Orpheum. I just finished late last night choosing our clips that are going to be shown from all of the Oscar-nominated Best Picture nominees, and it's just going to be a great night. Our critics save up their best back and forth for that special event. It's Sunday afternoon, March 3rd, exactly a week before the Oscars, at the Orpheum Theater on Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. So please join me. It's going to be a terrific event, as always. And we've added something new this year. That is, if you want to dress up in your Oscar finest, we'll have the red carpet out, and you can do a step and repeat with our background for LAist and take a photo of your guest for the evening. So if you want to come in your finery, please join us that way, too. It'll be wonderful. Also, have an opportunity for people who come to share messages to our Film Week critics. Be kind, but you'll have a chance to tell them about some of the favorite reviews you've heard over the years. Get your tickets now at LAist.com/events. That's LAist.com/events. I look forward to seeing you at the 22nd Annual Film Week Academy Awards preview in downtown Los Angeles. Well, we have a brand new season of Imperfect Paradise, the podcast series from LAist Studios. The new one focuses on Star Garden, the strip club in North Hollywood, which opened its doors, or reopened, I should say, about 6 months ago after a labor standoff between the dancers at the club who were organizing and the management of Star Garden. It was a 15-month-long campaign to unionize, and joining us, the producer and reporter of Imperfect Paradise Strippers Union, a four-part series, Emma Alabaster. Emma, so good to have you with us today.
Hi, Larry. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about just how unique what happened at Star Garden is. There had only been one other strip club in history that had unionized, as I understand.
Yeah, that's correct. So the first ever unionized strip club was a peep show in San Francisco called The Lusty Lady, but that closed in 2013. So Star Garden is only the second one ever. And to give some context, the Star Garden Union came in a big wave within the labor movement. There were strikes and efforts towards unionization happening across many industries. Sometimes we called it the hot labor summer. But this club in particular was pretty unusual in that it was at the time the only unionized strip club in the U.S. And since then, one other club has unionized in Portland, Oregon.
And what were the circumstances in your view at Star Garden that made it particularly ripe for unionization?
Yeah, so the dancers say that part of the reason they were able to unionize is that they developed a really strong backstage culture, and there was a lot of community building, a foundation that allowed them to organize. Our show includes interviews with a bunch of the dancers, and episode one focuses on a dancer who goes by Wicked. We use the dancer's stage names throughout. And Wicked was the first dancer hired at the club after the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. So when the club reopened, she was the first dancer there for a few weeks. And as other dancers were hired, she kind of set the tone and laid the ground rules for how things would operate. Many strippers I talked to said it's really common for clubs to be competitive. So dancers feel competitive with each other for money and tips. And Wicked decided to create a different kind of atmosphere. So she and the other dancers would help each other to get tips. They'd do things like coordinating schedules, setting COVID protocols. And the dancers told me that this supportive community was one of the things that helped them to organize when issues came up at the club. They felt like they could turn to each other and take action. One of the dancers, Reagan, told me that Wicked was the secret sauce that helped them to unionize.
And we're going to hear from Reagan momentarily because she's with us in studio today. But let's listen to an excerpt from Imperfect Paradise from LA's Studios, Strippers Union, a four-part series. You'll hear from Wicked and Selena talking about the environment that they built at Star Garden in North Hollywood.
I've been in some places where it's like, it's vicious and you are competing and you can't be friends with any of these strippers because they don't want to be your friend. That was what I told the strippers that were coming in, is like, we're going to do something different. We're going to do something special.
I've always been told to be that hard, competitive stripper, not be nice and not compliment and just stay to yourself type of thing. Wicked was just like really welcoming to everybody and would tell me encouraging things that you kind of need throughout the day.
That from Imperfect Paradise, the new season, four parts to the podcast series Strippers Union, with us producer and reporter Emma Alabaster. But Reagan, as I mentioned, one of the lead organizers of the unionizing effort at Star Garden and one of the founders of the Stripper Co-op, which is an offshoot of the union. Reagan, thanks so much for coming in to talk with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So how did you transition from this sort of competitive environment, which we've just heard described, to one where you were really able to pull people together to pursue this?
Well, actually, it had a lot to do with timing and circumstance and the fact that it was 2021. It was coming out of COVID. It was coming out of the shutdown, rather. And a lot happened during the shutdown in the dancer community. And there was a large contingent of us that found work for ourselves and each other online. And it was a lot of pulling together resources, putting shows together, and working together in a way that we never had before. And realizing that we could make an online club that we could profit from and profit together. And one of the shows that I was a part of, that I was one of the founding members of, we actually pooled all of our tips. And it was really like our slogans was camaraderie and community over competition.
And for the virtual shows that you did during the pandemic, were a lot of these people Star Garden customers that you knew over the years who came, or did you get a lot of new people?
It was both. It was it was customers that many of us had known from different clubs, and then it kind of found an audience even abroad, even people outside of Los Angeles. We had people tune in, and that was one of the great things about the virtual world, is you can tune in from anywhere. So we actually had a large audience. We were fortunate enough to get some media attention for it, because we were also giving a large portion of our profits to community aid and nonprofits. And we were just kind of trying to spread the love and sort of change our culture from within. And then when the clubs reopened, many of us didn't want to give that up. And that kind of bled into returning to the club and the fortune of having the opportunity to remake a club culture. And that was one of the beautiful things about walking into Star Garden and Wicked. When I was hired at Star Garden, there were two dancers that were on the roster besides me. One of them was Wicked, and all three of us worked together, and every new dancer that came in, we laid that foundation and that groundwork, and we said, we'll take care of you, like, let's work together, we can make more money together, and we can split the bag, like share the bag instead of getting your own bag.
So Reagan, what's it like now, 6 months into the reopening, and are you still negotiating the permanent contract, and what's the vibe like in the club?
Yeah, there's a lot to say about that, but we are still in negotiations, so that is an ongoing process. It's hard to know where to start, honestly. We are in a very critical moment, actually. That's why this is actually a really special moment to be promoting this podcast, because it's coming at a moment where you might think that this podcast is a retrospective of like this event that happened, but it's unfolding rapidly right now. And this is perhaps the most critical moment. We got to where we are because we were able to unionize an industry that was thought to be impossible, or at least very unlikely to unionize. And we did that by appealing to the National Labor Relations Board and filing unfair labor practice charges and asking the board to recognize our right to unionize, because we have the right to unionize as employees. And so we won that right. We won that fight. We won our union. And now we are asking the National Labor Relations Board to enforce the settlement agreement that they themselves negotiated on our behalf. And the law is useless if no one is enforcing it. And right now, the National Labor Relations Board is not enforcing the law. And so we are left high and dry. We feel completely abandoned. It is the most toxic and hostile work environment I have ever worked in.
It's worse now than it was before?
It is absolutely 100% worse. Everything about it is 100% worse. And so this is really great that we have this moment where we have people, new ears listening to our story and kind of coming on board, because we could really use the support, and we're looking to put pressure on the NLRB to make a decision and find them not in compliance of the settlement agreement and enforce the law.
Let's hear another excerpt from LAS Studios' Imperfect Paradise, the new season, Strippers Union. This featuring the dancer Onyx talking about how great it was to be an independent contractor.
Onyx's move into stripping was great at first, when she was an independent contractor.
I can make my own schedule, come in when I want, talk to whoever I want, give dances to whatever I want, wear what I want, do what I want, when I want it, how I want it, make money how I want it, and good money. I helped to pay my mama's mortgage. I got to go on vacation, take my cats to the vet. I got to just have more of a viable life. I didn't know how good I had it until it changed.
Emma Alabaster, producer and reporter of Imperfect Paradise Strippers Union. So, Emma, talk a little bit about that whole issue of the terms of employment typically for dancers in clubs.
Absolutely. So I think one of the really interesting things about the story that Reagan is speaking to and that Tate from Onyx is speaking to is that the strip club is a place where some of these questions about the best employment terms for workers are playing out pretty acutely. So I would say in 2020, there was a law that was passed in California called AB5, or the Gig Workers Bill, and it turned a lot of independent contractors into employees, and that really rocked the strip clubs. All the dancers I spoke to at different clubs, and to be clear, Onyx is not a dancer at Star Garden. She's another dancer that we spoke to who has a different perspective on what she thinks should happen in terms of employment status. So I'll get into that a little bit more. But when this law passed, a lot of dancers we spoke to said that it had a really negative impact on strip clubs, and specifically on more marginalized dancers. And all the dancers I spoke to said that what they want is safer working conditions and better money at their clubs, but a lot of them really disagree with how to get there. For a dancer like Onyx, she believes, as you heard in the clip, that independent contractor status is the best way forward for her. Some other dancers have advocated for employee status because it allows them more easily to unionize, as happened at Star Garden. And as you're hearing from Reagan, even, you know, getting the union, there's still more struggle after that for dancers to get a contract that they find favorable. So even though our podcast covers some of the nuance in these debates and some of these questions about what can actually be accomplished with union status, there's still a lot that remains to be seen. Mm. And episode 4 also dives into this worker cooperative model that Reagan was also talking about with these virtual shows. And some of the dancers have a dream as well of opening a stripper-owned worker cooperative club.
You know, it's fascinating because Reagan, as you probably know, even within the ride-hailing business, a huge split among drivers. There are those just like Onyx who, I want the flexibility. I'll deal with the downside of independent contractor status because it's more important for me to have that freedom. And then other people like, well, I can't make a living under independent contractor status. And so how do you, in your talks with other dancers, how do you sort of navigate this difference of opinion?
Yeah, it is a very contentious topic. And the reason for that, I believe, is because that bill, AB 5, was not written with strippers in mind. Very few bills are. And so we were kind of swept up with this other economy, with this other industry, with the rideshare workers, which is really what the bill was what was aiming towards. Strippers got swept up in the debris. I personally, and again, this is contentious and not every stripper agrees with me, but I think of AB5 as a wrecking ball, and it absolutely shattered what we knew of as the industry, the stripping industry in California. And what we have done with the union is make a life raft out of that debris from that wrecking ball. And so there's another camp that believes that a carve out is preferential, and that like carving the stripping industry out of AB5 is the better way to go. And I have to say, I agree that there are huge benefits to being an independent contractor. I also believe that it's possible to negotiate a contract that keeps all of those good things intact. Like, we don't have to lose the flexibility in scheduling. You just negotiate that in a contract. I just had no idea how easy it would be for employers to negotiate in bad faith and sabotage their own business.
Well, and there's sort of a bigger issue here, and I think you're kind of getting at it. And my apologies, I don't know if you consider yourself a sex worker or not. I don't know where you would put what you do, but I think generally those who do work with any sort of sexual or nudity involved in it, there's no place to sort of sit under the law there so often because of the kind of marginalization and the sorts of views historically we've had about doing that kind of work. And how much of that do you see factoring into this?
Yeah, that it's huge. And I do consider myself a sex worker, especially just in solidarity with the whole umbrella term of who does sex work. Yeah, and that makes this complicated. And I really believe that I believe that this is a step forward. And I want to walk back what I said earlier, because I don't think that everything is worse. I think that the environment inside of the club is worse, and that is intentional. That is the employer trying to starve us out and sabotage the negotiations he's negotiating in bad faith. That aside, a lot of good has been done here, and I do think that we are still in the process of making these gains, and that's why we're asking again for like public support and to put pressure on the NLRB, because we are looking ahead with the exact same goal to protect the most marginalized workers, because that is our community. We are the most, like, the stripper community, the sex worker community, we need that protection.
We're talking with Reagan, one of the lead organizers of the unionization effort at Star Garden in North Hollywood. She's also one of the founders of the Stripper Co-op, an offshoot of the union. Star Garden management declined multiple requests to be interviewed for the podcast Imperfect Paradise Strippers Union, but there were statements issued by their attorneys. Emma Alabaster, producer and reporter of the series, can you just briefly tell us what Star Garden has essentially said in response to the kinds of concerns Reagan has shared?
Sure. In a press release from the club's lawyer, they said, quote, Star Garden denies in engaging in any unfair labor practice, end quote. And they cited some other actions from the dancers that they found disruptive. For example, they cited the dancers coming to the club dressed as clowns or in Handmaid's Tale costumes. And they found that disruptive to the customers. I spoke with Reagan and some of the other dancers about that and those costumes, which are something that when they were on the picket line and also in the club, sometimes they coordinate themed outfits. And the management found that disruptive and also claimed that dancers were not coming out on the floor on their shifts or other things like that. Basically, it seems like management is claiming that the dancers are disrupting business and dancers are claiming that management is disrupting business. And in the meantime, you know, the union is still in contract negotiations, as Reagan has said.
I'm looking forward to hearing all four parts of the series. The first episode, by the way, is out and available now. It launched today. New episodes will drop every Wednesday. It's available wherever you get your podcasts and also airs here on LAist 89.3 Sunday nights at 7 o'clock. Emma Alabaster, the producer and reporter of Imperfect Paradise Strippers Union. Emma, thank you so much for joining us. Reagan, thank you for coming in studio and talking with us as well. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Come to Star Garden and don't ask for Steve because he pretends that Steve is not a person. He goes by Mike.
All right. I need to break off. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, we're going to talk about a condition that affects about a quarter of women, and that's pain during intercourse. We're going to talk about different treatments and different approaches to it when we come back in just 1 minute.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. The LA Times recently highlighted the organization known as Tight Lipped, a grassroots organization advocating for people with chronic vulvovaginal and pelvic pain. It's not clear exactly how many women suffer from this condition or conditions like vulvovaginia, but research has estimated as many as 16% of women. Sometimes it's estimated even higher. Pelvic pain can negatively impact romantic relationships and can lead to deep feelings of shame and of loneliness. Joining us to talk about vulvovaginal disorders is Dr. Kylie Moss, gynecologist with the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders, also an adjunct assistant professor at George Washington University in D.C. Dr. Moss, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is something that I think many of us have heard about, but had no idea the prevalence of it. And, you know, give us a sense of how common it is among American women.
Vulvodynia is one of the kinds of pain with sex. There are lots of kinds of pain with sex. But just as you said, there are estimates that are as high as 28% of people in reproductive age who have pain with intercourse or vulvodynia. So it's incredibly common. And it's also something that we don't get a ton of training on in educational programs, but lots of people are working to rectify that. At GW, Sarah Signa has started a fellowship for people who are studying pain with sex. So I think there are a lot of hopeful signs that we're going to learn more about this and be able to treat this better in the future.
And so just generally what we're talking about here is pain in the vulva. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, so if you're talking about vulvodynia, that's the term that's historically been used for any pain that's part of the external female genitalia. And the vulva is where most genital sensation originates. It's vital to sexual pleasure and comfort. And the reason that most genital pain is in the vulva is because of its sensory role. And from a technical standpoint, vulvodynia is pain that's at least 3 months duration without another readily identifiable cause in the vulva.
So the percentage would be much higher if you just looked at an episodic vulvodynia, for example.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, certainly lots of people have intermittent or episodic pain with intercourse beyond a technical vulvodynia diagnosis.
So for the chronic condition, what are some of the causes?
So many causes. One of the most common things we see at the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders is hormonal changes from things like menopause or certain medications. Contraceptive pills can sometimes have an adverse effect at the vestibule and affect comfort with sex. Also, people who are lactating can have pain with sex related to lack of estrogen and testosterone at the opening of the vulva called the vestibule. So those are just the hormonal, like broad categories of hormonal concerns. But there are also things like nerve injury related to childbirth or even spinal injury that can affect pain with sex.
Do people who suffer from chronic pain generally with other locations of the body, are they more prone to have this? In other words, sort of because the pain sensors are turned on generally?
There are certainly underlying conditions that can predispose to both vulvovaginal pain and other pain conditions. And certainly we see overlap with things like fibromyalgia. But there are certainly people who have pain in isolation that are, you know, unrelated to other chronic pain conditions.
We're talking with Dr. Kylie Moss, gynecologist with the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders and an adjunct professor at George Washington University. I'd like to hear from you if you're someone who is dealing with this or has dealt with chronic vulvovaginia, if you'd like to weigh in with how it was treated, any frustrations you had with the health care that you received when you identified the symptoms to your physician, things that were particularly effective for you, please share your experience at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. If you've preferred to share your experience via email, that's great. We're at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. How beneficial can lubricants be for this? Is the pain so severe that in most cases that just can't address the issue?
I think part of the problem with it is that vulvodynia is such a broad term. When we're talking about, you know, pain with sex, it can be because of the labia, it can be because of the clitoris, it can be because of the vestibule. So if lubricant can address the problem, if the problem is one of lubrication, but there are so many different causes of pain with sex, you really need someone who's trained in a more algorithmic approach to assess the causes and do a careful physical exam to determine what's going to help. It's not wrong to try a lubricant if you're having pain, especially with insertion during intercourse. But if it persists, it's really something that needs to be addressed by someone who has a systematic approach because the area is so complicated.
And how difficult is it to find a specialist in this? Because you were mentioning that there's a real absence of training for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's getting better. And people like Andrew Goldstein, who started the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders, Jill Kraft, who is also at the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders and a really important mentor of mine. There are people all over the country in pockets, but and those people have been working really hard to train others. But it is challenging. The people that come to us have often seen, on average, at least 6 or 7 other providers before they get to us. So it is really challenging, but it's something that we're trying to spread the word about and educate people both about their own anatomy and clinicians about techniques to address pain, like conditions that cause pain with sex.
Dr. Kylie Moss with us. Also joining us is Stephanie Prendergast, who's co-founder of the Pelvic Pain and Rehabilitation Center. She's a pelvic floor physical therapist who specializes in pelvic pain. Stephanie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So share with us your experience with this and how you ended up specializing in this form of PT.
So I began specializing in pelvic floor disorders in 2001, mostly because I was kind of disenchanted with the field of physical therapy and felt like I should have gone to medical school. So I worked in an interdisciplinary setting with a urologist, a sex therapist, and really seeing that patients my age could not sit down, have sex. They had irritated bladder symptoms. They couldn't wear pants. Just was more interesting to me than somebody who sprained their ankle and maybe, you know, needed a little bit of rehab. And what I saw in my beginning years was how the interdisciplinary team can really work together to help these patients. As Dr. Moss stated, there are medical causes that can cause anatomic changes in the vulvovaginal area. But in addition to that, whether it's a cause or effect, the pelvic floor muscles actually contribute to a fair amount of vulvar pain symptoms. And that has been published, and there's significant evidence across the board that the pelvic floor muscles are associated both with vulvodynia, which we're talking about now, but also a condition called interstitial cystitis, painful bladder syndrome. And these overlap in these two patients. Many patients that have pain with penetration also have urinary urgency, frequency, and pain that is not related to an infection. And the connecting factor between these two different areas is the pelvic floor muscles, but also the pelvic girdle. So where pelvic floor physical therapy can come in is we will assess the musculoskeletal system, some of the neurologic structures, and then be able to identify physical impairments that make sense with the patient's symptoms and presentation.
And are these exercises that women can do regularly at home to build those muscles?
So that's a tricky thing right there. In the American Urologic Association guidelines, what's actually indicated for these patients is manual therapy. So because these muscles don't cross a joint, a lot of times we're doing transvaginal, transrectal work during the course of their clinical appointment to help the muscles relax. They're actually too tight. And then we can supplement that with some homework at home, but it often needs a combination of both.
Interesting. So the muscles are too tight. So if you do exercises to strengthen the muscles, that could make it worse?
It definitely makes it worse. And in fact, some of the guidelines state that it's contraindicated for people with some of these pain disorders to actually do the strengthening exercises.
Do you think that some women are doing the exercises
Yes.
when they shouldn't be?
Yes, because understandably, people think about their pelvic floor. They think about Kegels. That's something that most people know. They don't realize that the muscles can get tight and cause the symptoms I described. Nobody thinks, oh, I should go see a physical therapist because it hurts when I have sex.
Well, I think the good thing you mentioned is this goes beyond pain and sex, as important as that is. But you mentioned all these other activities that can be compromised as a result of the pain.
Exactly. It does affect a lot of things. It affects urinary bowel and sexual function. So while we say vulvodynia, a lot of these pelvic pain diagnoses are actually just symptom descriptors, and we really need to get to the bottom with a physician and a PT about what's the underlying impairments.
We're talking with physical therapist Stephanie Prendergast, who is co-founder of the Pelvic Pain and Rehabilitation Center, a pelvic floor physical therapist who specializes in pelvic pain. We're talking about chronic vulvovaginal disorders, the challenges women have in the treatment, and often even the diagnosis of what's going on. We're joined by Dr. Kylie Moss, gynecologist with the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders. Also with us coming up will be Kana Cassard, who's a licensed marriage family therapist and a founder of Sex Answered, which is an unconventional sex therapy intervention center. One of the specialties is on painful sex. We'll talk with Kana when we come back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about chronic pain during sex, vulvovaginal disorders, and the treatments that are available, the challenges in getting a kind of detailed, clear diagnosis so that women can have a treatment plan that's gonna reduce the pain or eliminate the pain over time. We're talking with gynecologist Dr. Kylie Moss of the Center for Vulvovaginal Disorders, Stephanie Prendergast, who is a co-founder of the Pelvic Pain and Rehabilitation Center. She's a physical therapist. And also with us, Kana Cassard, who's a licensed marriage family therapist and sex therapist and specializes in painful sex and how to treat that. Kana, thank you very much for joining us today. Kana, are you there?
Giving it.
Oh, there we go.
Yes. Hi. Yeah, really glad to be here. It's a really important topic to cover, so thank you for doing this.
And let me ask, because I know that this, for you, part of this is your own experience going through this. You know, share with us how you dealt with that and what help you found or didn't.
Yeah, that's right. Back in about 2005, when I was on my path to becoming a sex therapist, excuse me, I'm just getting over a COVID infection. So.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Doing okay, though. Glad to be here for it. So I was on my path to becoming a sex therapist, and I started to have pain during intercourse myself. And I went to probably 8 gynecologists who just kind of looked at me and were like, I don't know, you need to relax more, have a glass of wine, use more lube. And it felt really lonely and isolating, and I felt really dismissed and like something was broken, because I hadn't heard about any of this in my sex therapy courses. There was a little bit of mention, but not too much. It was more just like, yeah, it just is kind of a thing. But I spent a long time searching in a variety of holistic treatments and was finally connected with a gynecologist who validated my experience and knew exactly what was going on, and so provided the treatment for me. But I had gone through about a decade of just having no answers and no hope and nowhere to go with it. So it was a really difficult process. And I'm so glad that we've come so far. Like Dr. Moss was saying, there's a lot of work that we're trying to do to get this, to get more awareness to this.
And Dr. Moss, I wanted to ask you about, you know, because we just heard from Kana Cassard about how very little of this was in the training for licensed marriage family therapists. But Dr. Moss, is there more instruction of this in OBGYN specialty programs to help prepare docs to help patients with this?
I think it's really variable. I think we got some training where I was at Ohio State, but which is where I was for residency, but it's completely variable. Sarah Signa, again, at GW is amazing, and she's doing a lot to have medical students rotate with her so that, you know, medical students, even who aren't becoming OBGYNs, can get more sense of this and have a better toolkit for patients. I think, you know, the specific training is important, but it's also important that we just imbue students and residents with the sense that if they can't help a patient, then there are two solutions. You can either refer them to someone who you think can help them for their problem, or look into it and learn more about it yourself. And I think the problem is when people are dismissed because it's an inconvenient thing because the person doesn't have the training. It's okay not to have the training as long as you continue to be curious or send the person to someone who can help them. And we are studying actually medical gaslighting in the population of people who are experiencing vulvovaginal disorders, and find that these things that you were told are so common. Tons of women get told, oh, this is just part of, you know, a normal sexual experience, and it isn't. And it's not fair that people have to live with this or be told or dismissed for the symptoms that they are themselves experiencing.
Well, I can understand it might be beneficial to hear you're not alone, that this is not uncommon. But as you say, then just, well, there's not much we can do about it, or just go about your life and try and figure this out on your own. Obviously not helpful and stress inducing. And I guess I'm just wondering if there's a way to formalize this more so that this doesn't get ignored.
I mean, I think that there are resources. It's just people have to be curious to find them. I think there are fantastic, like there's a fantastic textbook that Andrew Goldstein wrote called Female Sexual Pain Disorders for clinicians who have a patient in front of them that they don't know, you know, what to do about. And we have an algorithmic approach to people who have pain at the vestibule that can be incredibly helpful. So I think, and for patients, I think resources like the book When Sex Hurts, or I mean, there are lots of great resources out there. But the point is, like, continuing to be curious and work on the problem rather than telling people that it's, you know, there's nothing that can be done, because there are things we can do.
Kana Kassard, I wanted to ask you about what, if any, role a partner in sex can play during this. What can they do to be supportive and to help their partner make progress?
Yeah, they can do so much. A lot of times patients will come to me thinking that they have to do it all on their own. And even if they have the most supportive, wonderful, understanding partners, a lot of times both partners don't really know exactly how to help each other through it. And so usually the patient ends up becoming the identified patient, the one that has to take on all the emotional labor. So in the work that we do, there's a lot of patient education about how to rewire the brain so that the nervous system reduces in its reactivity, and the partner can learn all of those tools and techniques that go along with reducing reactivity to sex and intimacy. Because there's often a process that happens even before sex starts. Like if a partner will go in to kiss their partner and, you know, they know that they want to take it somewhere to the bedroom, the pain patient will often already be sort of sensing this idea of like, oh no, this is going to lead to pain or disappointment or guilt or conflict, and I really just don't even want to go there. So they start to shut down. And that's this sexual dance, or this like intimate or sexual avoidance stance that often happens. And so interrupting that process, it goes so much faster, and it's a lot easier when both people get involved. And there can be so many other things that a partner can do to help support their partner as well, in like at home exercises. They can set up the room if the pain patient needs to be doing their dilator exercises, for instance. Doing anything to just kind of help with the emotional load really signals to the pain patient that this is not only in their body, it's a part, they can both be a part of the solution together.
Stephanie Prendergast, can you speak to dilation exercises? Is that something and that would be done in the home as sort of prelude to intercourse?
Yes, and that, it sounds like it sounds, a dilator basically helps to improve the diameter of the vaginal opening, or they can be used to help try to relax the muscles at home. And I want to insert, a lot of patients may buy these online themselves and try to start using them without the direction of a skilled provider, and they can actually hurt themselves. So when people are trying to help themselves and they're trying to do these things at home, if it's causing an extreme amount of pain, it may be because there is a nerve issue. There could be vestibulodynia that needs other treatment before the dilators are safe and appropriate. But what I see is patients are so desperately wanting to get better, they keep doing this anyway because they believe it's going to help. And so we just want to tell people to listen to their bodies. And if they're really struggling, they don't have a provider, if it hurts, it may not be the right time to do the dilation exercises.
And I could see where if there's a regular partner for sex, where this could be helpful, the partner may be even involved in that and responsive. But if you don't have a partner, if you're someone who's, you're having sex, you have a regular sex life, but you're not in a relationship, you're with different people, it's got to be incredibly challenging.
It is. It's very difficult for the patients. And again, some people push through and other people retreat.
You're just always explaining yourself.
Or in feeling anxious about the problem.
And Kana Kassard, can you speak to that? What are ways that you help your clients who aren't in a relationship but want to have an active sex life?
Yeah, because this is something that often keeps people from dating. It holds them back. They constantly think about, oh gosh, I have to have the sex talk about my pain condition. And so being able to look at their current situation, and you know, each person is
individual in their process. And so looking at what works for them is a really great starting point, assessing where they're at, whether they're using sexual toys or sex toys like vibrators, whether they're having a self-love practice or not. And if they're not, being able to find techniques that they can start to incorporate pleasure-based but not sexual pleasure-based, if it feels more comfortable with them. Because a lot of people who have dealt with sexual pain issues often don't even want to connect to sexual pleasure. And they often have a challenge in seeking help around their sex life with a sex therapist, because it becomes such of a emotionally burdensome topic.
Yeah.
But there can be a lot of tools and techniques to do just by getting creative with what they're already comfortable with.
And it's just, it's got to be as the patient sees progress in this, it's got to be so rewarding, that feeling of starting to incorporate sex back into your life if the patient hasn't felt able to do that. It's got to be like a part of yourself being able, pardon the pun, to turn on again, to be able to take part. Kana Cassard with us, licensed marriage family therapist. Stephanie Prendergast, who's a physical therapist who specializes in pelvic pain. And Dr. Kylie Moss, who's with the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders and gynecologist. We'll continue our conversation, and I welcome your input. If this is something you've experienced, you can join us at 866-893-5722. We'll be back in a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about vulvovaginal disorders or pain during sex. Joining us, Dr. Kylie Moss, gynecologist, Stephanie Prendergast, who's a physical therapist, and Kana Cassard, licensed marriage and family therapist. We have a question from Marie in Los Angeles, said, why don't we know more about pelvic floor physical therapy? Stephanie?
I think it's not natural to think about physical therapy when we describe the symptoms that we did. And it's a profession that's definitely on the rise. Similar to what Dr. Moss stated, we are not taught anything regarding pelvic floor dysfunction in physical therapy school still to this day. And therefore, anyone who is a pelvic floor physical therapist has had to spend a lot of time and money to get advanced training to be able to start to treat this patient population. Most gynecologists, urologists, primary care doctors may not be aware that we're even a discipline unless they've sought out specialty training. It's just not part of their curricula. And so it's on the rise, but it's not commonly thought of.
And so you took specialized training in this then?
Yes, I was trained by a physician. And so my experience was very different early on, and all pelvic pain patients immediately from the moment I started.
Jude in Culver City said, I was wondering about vaginal atrophy, whether it has any relation to this. Dr. Moss.
Yeah, it absolutely does. So we're trying to steer away from vaginal atrophy just because it has such a negative connotation, and steer towards genitourinary syndrome of menopause. So in people who have a lack of estrogen, they can have less support for lubrication and resilience of the tissue, particularly at the opening called the vestibule, that's deeper in the vulva, and that can cause tremendous pain, but can also be really pretty easily remedied with topical hormonal therapies. And these are things that people can use even if they have contraindication to other kinds of hormonal therapies. Topical hormonal therapies are not absorbed systemically generally in large percent. So they're very safe to use, and they can make a huge difference. And that can be the case for people who have other reasons for hormonal changes in the area, not just because of menopause.
Emily in Westlake wonders, what should we be telling women about birth control in regards to vulvodynia?
I would say there's a huge number of types of birth control. There can be some people who have trouble with combined hormonal contraception, especially. So what we would historically call the pill, usually a combination of estrogen and progesterone. Our group did a study that showed that there are people who have changes genetically in their testosterone receptors. And when you take an oral estrogen, it increases a protein called sex hormone binding globulin that can make it harder for there to be estrogen and testosterone at the vestibule, this deep ring of tissue in the vulva that's really important for lubrication and comfort during intercourse. It isn't everybody on the pill, and I'm a gynecologist. There are lots of good applications of the pill, but for some people, they will notice discomfort with intercourse on it, and for those people, it may not be the best form of contraception. It's always about risks and benefits and how the individual patient experiences the medication, but it is a consideration for some people.
Keena in Hollywood wonders, any recommendations for how patients dealing with pelvic pain can connect with others in similar circumstances? Doctor?
Oh, there are lots of great resources. I think Tight-Lipped, which you mentioned at the top of the show, is a great resource. There's the National Vulvodynia Association, which can be really helpful. The International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health has a patient-facing website called ProSela that's going to have lots of great information that's headed by Rachel Rubin, who's a urologist who does a lot of sexual medicine. The International Society for the Study of Vulvovaginal Disorders also has resources for patients. So there are lots of places that people can look for support for these kinds of things.
Keena Cassard, I wanted to ask you, and we're almost out of time, so it has to be really fast. I'm sorry. The mind-body connection here, does this end up sometimes in a feedback loop?
Definitely. The more pain that a person experiences and the more, you know, emotional pain, the more they're going to want to stay in an avoidance cycle. And then that keeps them from having positive experiences. So if there isn't some sort of intervention done, then you can't break the feedback cycle.
All right. And I wanted to ask you, Stephanie Prendergast, are there resources available to help women find physical therapists like yourself specializing in pelvic floor treatment?
Yes, there are several websites that we always direct patients to. One is the pelvic health section of the American Physical Therapy Association. They have a finder provider link. Herman and Wallace is a postgraduate continuing education company. They also have a find a provider link. The society that Dr. Moss mentioned, the International Society for Study of Women's Sexual Health, has a resource as well.
All right. And Dr. Moss, just in closing, it sounds like it's very important for patients describing this pain to not have it brushed off. They really need to be relentless and consistent in making sure that they get a proper diagnosis and treatment. Any other advice beyond being relentless in this?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that there will be a future where they don't have to be as relentless because knowledge about these conditions is more commonplace. And so I think the onus is on us as medical providers to be better and be curious and investigate and help patients.
All right. I want to thank Dr. Kylie Moss, gynecologist with the Centers for Vulvovaginal Disorders. My thanks to Stephanie Prendergast of the Pelvic Pain and Rehabilitation Center and Keena Cassard, licensed marriage family therapist and founder of Sex Answered, a trauma-informed intervention center. Have a terrific day.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.